I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with Ed Opperman, digital private investigator and host of The Opperman Report. I'm not sure how to sum up Ed Opperman in a few sentences. It's very difficult because he's lived a very wild, storied life, adventuring around the world with characters like the Yippies. And of course, dealing with the ex-LA FBI agent, Ted Gunderson, who was involved in COINTELPRO, and also inserted himself into the satanic ritual abuse claims of the 1980s and 1990s. Hell, Ed's even involved in the legal controversies of the late Coast to Coast AM host Art Bell. What's more, he's been involved in the Tiger Woods case, porn star Capri Anderson's case against Charlie Sheen, and there's even a bit of a connection to Stormy Daniels. We talk about all that and much more in my conversation with Ed Opperman. And we also discuss the Opperman Report radio show and podcast, which I highly recommend listening to. Ed gets a lot of great exclusive interviews that you won't hear anywhere else. To transition into the interview with Ed Opperman, I've got a remix of the Twin Peaks theme by Akira the Dawn. I thought it would be apropos, as Ed has covered a lot of conspiracy topics, as well as true crime topics, on his own show, The Opperman Report. And of course, Twin Peaks sort of combines all those elements together. So I hope you enjoy my interview with Ed Opperman. It's a great conversation. But first, here's Akira the Dawn with a remix of the Twin Peaks theme.
Akira.
The Dawn.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Ed Opperman.
Hey, Joe. Thank you so much.
So, you have this show, the Opperman Report, which is a very interesting show covering a wide variety of topics from conspiracy theory to true crime and much, much more. But you have a very storied sort of history. You started out, I guess, as a digital PI?
Yeah. No, I didn't start out as a digital PI. I started out as a regular private investigator. I started out as an information broker, is what they used to call it in the old days, that you could buy and sell information to PIs and to lawyers and collection agencies and stuff like that. And you didn't need a PI license back in those days, but now you do. And so I started out, I had this connection in the phone company where if I had someone's phone number, even if it was an unlisted number, from that I could get their name, their address, a list of all the calls they made. You could get the local usage calls and the long distance calls from their house that they were making, or they didn't have cell phones back in those days. This is back in the '70s. And you'd get also too their social security number and their work phone number and even sometimes their bank account number. So this was gold. This is golden information. You know, they didn't have identity theft back in those days, but this was you could locate people, you could collect on people and stuff like that. So that's how I got to meet all the PIs in New York, and I got set up out of this office in Brooklyn with this really he was a forensic investigator. He did fingerprints and ballistics and all that kind of stuff. And then I got hooked up with all the lawyers in New York and stuff like that. And that's how I got started in the PI business.
Wow. And you're known for a website, emailreviller.com. What's that about? Tell my listeners about that.
Well, what happened was, okay, emailreviller.com. Originally, we had gotten this contract to do employment screening for UPS. And this was like around 2000. Me and my partner was NYPD Harbor Aviation in New York City. One of those helicopter scuba cops that would jump out of the helicopters, like those guys who rescued that woman off the Statue of Liberty yesterday. That's what he worked in. And we got this contract with UPS to do employment screening. So before they would hire somebody, we would run their criminal records, their credit report, stuff like that to find out and verify their social security number. So we had that going, but we lost that contract. But we were all set up. We had this great office in Colorado. We had all these employees sitting around, wanted to earn money. And I had learned how to trace emails, how to locate and identify somebody from an email address. And back around that time in 2000, no one was doing what I was doing with emails. It was unheard of. I was being stalked. We'll talk about it later on, but during the Art Bell controversy, I was being stalked online, and I need to locate and identify people from their email address. And I contacted people I knew in the business. How do you do this? And they had these wacky methods of tracing the IP address back using a DNS traceroute and that kind of stuff. And I said, no, I need the guy's name. I need to locate this guy and identify him. So I came up with some little tricks and traps to identify people and locate them from their email address. And that's why I named the company emailrevealer.com. Then from that, I was doing so much with emails that like no one was doing what I was doing with emails back in those days. And I came up with this little method to catch people cheating online. I could trace an email address back to online dating websites and personal ads and catch them cheating online. So then we added that service. And then also, too, it has all the regular stuff, locates, asset searches, adoption investigations. All the regular stuff, locate personal place of employment, all the stuff, name and address from a phone number, all that stuff you find on any PI website. And then I got into digital forensics in 2003. I actually stumbled upon these guys who were the guys in Afghanistan who cloned Osama bin Laden's phone. Okay. This company, they were based out of Utah and they were based out of Virginia. And I hooked up with them because when I saw what they were doing with cell phones, they could recover deleted text messages out of a cell phone and create a whole report, downloading all the information from the cell phone, caller ID, pictures, deleted pictures and stuff. I says, wow, this is great for infidelity investigations because I was doing a lot of infidelity stuff back in those days. So I hooked up with them. I started sending them my phones. I would get phones from the public and send it to them and they would do it for me. But then I got all the training, I got all the software, and now I got all the big expensive software too, cost a fortune, Cellbrite and all that kind of stuff like the Encase. all the big fancy stuff I got now. And so we can, you know, do hard drives and cell phones, recover deleted text messages and stuff like that as well. So I'm also a digital forensic investigator.
Wow. It sort of brings to mind, you were doing this stuff before all that Ashley Madison stuff hit a few years ago.
Oh, man. I could tell you. Let me tell you. I was at war with Ashley Madison for years and years and years. Yes, because when I came up with my little system to find people on dating sites, they were one of the sites I could do. And so then they would hire me. They would use fake accounts and fake names to hire me to see if I could catch them on Ashley Madison. And then they would try and figure out how I did it and then change their setup so I couldn't do it anymore. And they would actually change the advertising. At one time, they would advertise saying that if you're on Ashley Madison, no one can find out. No one could catch you. And then they had to pull down all those ads. And then they thought that they got me again, and they put the ads back up, and I got back in. So I was back and forth. But it turned out in the end that Ashley Madison was pretty much a hoax, that those are mostly fake accounts on there.
I didn't realize that. I know there was like a big blowout when the story first broke.
Yeah, they got hacked, quote unquote. A lot of these stories you hear about people getting hacked, it was an inside. It was a former employee who got in there and pulled all the database out of there and started selling it and making it public. I think he threatened to blackmail them first, and then he made it public. And it turned out, and then it's a searchable database now you can still use. But I don't even bother with it anymore because it turned out that almost all the people in there were fake accounts.
Wow. Wow. Well, what would you say as someone who works with emails and you know, this digital PI stuff, what's your best advice for people who sort of want to keep their information protected or, you know, or worry about getting hacked?
Yeah, you know, you got these people that try and use proxy servers and stuff like that. But the real – and when you have people doing that, those are pretty much the easy ones to catch because they get sloppy. You can trick people into revealing who they are online. For the average person, what I would tell you to do is – if you're going to be going on Craigslist and you're going to be doing goofy stuff online, okay, if you're going to be being goofy, create a separate email just for that. You know, have an email account that doesn't reveal your name or anything like that. It's just a very anonymous email on Gmail. And just use that one account with your fake name. And don't ever, ever, ever use it with PayPal or purchase something online with it. Or just think, you know, I got that email account. Let me just use it once. Because once you do, you're on the radar, you know, because people will try and stalk people on an email address that they've used with PayPal, that they've used, they've purchased things with their credit card, and you can track all that stuff down. So first of all, don't do stupid things online is another thing too. Try not to fight with people online. You have no idea. The biggest cyber stalking cases I've worked on started out where one person just offended another person. And didn't even think anything of it and just went on with their life. And years later, they were being stalked and harassed, and their family and their employer and their relatives were just being harassed relentlessly for years and years and years over a slight that you and I wouldn't even consider. I get 100 crazy emails a day, you know. But I got to tell you, be nice to people online as much as you can, unless you want to really be a target.
Well, that may be a good way to segue into your involvement in the whole Art Bell controversy. What was that all about? How are you involved with Art Bell?
Well, okay, that is a good way to segue because that's how Email Revealer got started, because I was being stalked by that Art Bell crowd. The people who were stalking Art Bell started stalking me. What happened was I used to listen to Art Bell, and I enjoyed the show, but I wasn't a fanatic or anything like that or took it too seriously. And one day – I was stuck at home. I was having my bathroom redone. I lived in New York City in this condo on the third floor, and they were putting a new bathroom in for me. And the guy screwed up, and I had no bathroom for like 3 days or 4 days. So I couldn't leave my house. I couldn't take a shower. I couldn't leave my house. I was stuck at house. And I just sat there drinking Remy Martin, you know, and arguing with people online. And I found this on the Art Bell website. They said that there's a feud between Art Bell and David Oates. And David Oates was this guy who did reverse speech. You know, he thought he invented this process where he could listen things backwards and come up with secret messages out of it. And so he said, click on this message, on this link, and you'll see this website called Howl. It was a message board where everybody was arguing about this feud. And I just made a couple of comments. I saw that some women, what happened was Art Bell had been threatened. He had started hearing words through the grapevine that David Oates was threatening his life by these two witnesses, these two women, who had actually dated Oates. So they were credible witnesses. And Bell went to the FBI. And then Bell had his big falling out with Oates. And so the people on his website were threatening these two witnesses. So I just said, hey, listen, you know, if you're a witness in an FBI investigation, you're being threatened, you know, that's a crime. Contact the FBI. So they thought I was Art Bell right away. And so this little debate went on and on and on for weeks and weeks and weeks, you know. And I really got into it and became fascinated with it. And then this other character showed up named Robert A.M. Stevens. He was this guy from Montana. And he went on the Jeff Rentz show one night claiming he was a Navy SEAL and he worked for NASA and he was a cowboy and a fireman and almost a secret spy and all this kind of stuff. And he got into a big fight with Art Bell, too, because he was invited on Art Bell with Richard Hoagland. And they cut him off right in the beginning because he was acting so crazy. So Oates and the Stevens started really, really stalking Art Bell and saying some crazy things about him. And they set up websites. And then this group called Spam House got involved. And they were longtime stalkers of Bell who were mostly doing parody and wacky bits and cartoons and doing memes and stuff like that and making fun of Art Bell and stuff like that. But they got involved in this whole stalking, too, which was pretty intense. And long story short, Oates tried to do an investigation on Bell and came up with some information which was totally wrong and confused and erroneous, that somehow Bell was involved with molesting children. And what happened in reality was is that Art Bell's son was kidnapped by his teacher in Pahrump and was put in chains and drugged and was taken to a remote location and raped. And so Bell was all upset about his son being raped. And this somehow came conflated into this theory that somehow Bell was the rapist. Because, you know, he was keeping things kind of secret. Ultimately, Bell had enough of this. He hired an attorney, Beverly Hills attorney, sued these two characters for $60 million. I had been so involved in this online debate that I had been contacted. I contacted Bell a couple of times, and he contacted me, and they published my email at one point. I was very upset about that. Keith Rowland published my email. I was upset with him. But we kind of made up and went along. And it came to the point where it started to look like Oates and Robert A.M. Stevens wanted to settle the lawsuit. They were sick of fighting. It was going on for so long. So I contacted Oates one night, and I said, hey, let's negotiate a settlement. And I gave him a cell phone number I had that was untraceable, and we talked on the phone back and forth, and he says, yeah, I want to settle. I want to see. He had this thick Australian accent, you know? And he goes, oh, I have to settle. Let's settle this lawsuit. I says, okay, I got him in the palm of my hand. This is great. So he says, I just need the money back that I paid my attorney. I paid my attorney $15,000, he tells me. So I go back to Bell, and I says, hey, you know, listen, I settled it for you. This guy wants to settle the lawsuit. He just wants his legal fees. Can you help him out? And Bell goes, oh, no, his legal fees aren't $15,000. It was only $1,000. He says, here. He says, by mistake, they sent me, when he sent over this letter to me, they also sent over the retainer agreement that he had with his lawyer by mistake. Here, I'll send it to you. So he faxes me Oates' retainer agreement with his lawyer. So now I'm all pissed off at Oates. I call him back. And I go, hey, listen, man, you're lying to me. I says, we can't have a deal here if you're lying to me. I says, and he goes, what are you talking about? I'm not lying to you. So I go, no, man, look, I got it right here. And I start reading his retainer agreement to him with his own lawyer. And he flips out. Who are you? Who are you? They thought I was like the CIA or the FBI undercover or something like that, that I was tapping his phones or something. But anyway, long story short, I finally Oates and me were negotiating back and forth with Bell. It was going on forever. And it was really taking up a lot of my time, too. I had my own things I wanted to do. And but Oates tells me, well, here's my plan. I'm not going to fight the lawsuit. I'm going to take a summary judgment, and then I'm going to declare bankruptcy. So I told Bell, I said, here's his plan. He's going to do bankruptcy. And Bell tells his lawyer, and they come back to me and says, hey, you know what? He can't do that. Because if he does that, he's creating a debt in anticipation of bankruptcy, and that's illegal. You can't do that. So I did an affidavit for Bell And I sent him the affidavit. He posted it on his website. I still have part of it. I have the first couple of pages to it, but there's the pieces that are missing. I'll post it up one day. I did a whole story about this, by the way. It's at AlpermanReport.com, where I tell the whole long story in detail. It's a whole – it went on for 2 years. Yeah. So I did my affidavit, and Oates had to settle. They settled on the air. They apologized to each other. And then Rams still went on and stuff. He was going crazy. Rams was a crazy guy too, by the way. And me and him used to go at it, trolling each other in the middle of the night. In this alcohol-fueled rampage me and him were going through at the time. And he was actually threatening my life, you know. He would be making serious, credible threats against my life. And Bell took the threats against my life and put them in a request for a restraining order down there in Pahrump for him. Bell got a restraining order against Stevens using the threats that Stevens made against me. But I'm sitting here with no restraining order, no protection, no nothing. But he's running me, and Bell's getting restraining order for himself. Anyway, so then what happened was, at the same time, too, unrelated to all this, Ted Gunderson had made some statements on a shortwave radio program here in Las Vegas.
Could you tell us who Ted Gunderson is for my listeners that may not be familiar?
Good point. Ted Gunderson was the L.A. Los Angeles special agent in charge of Los Angeles FBI. And he was an FBI agent for many, many years, 20, 30 years. And he was in California and Los Angeles in the FBI running that office during the whole COINTELPRO program against the Black Panthers and all that kind of stuff. He left the FBI and went to work on the Jeffrey McDonald, criminal case. It was like a murder case that Jeffrey McDonald was a captain in the I guess it was the U.S. Army.
I thought he was like a Green Beret. I could be wrong.
Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah, because he definitely had that beret hat on. I know that. Okay. And his family was murdered down there on the base, and his Marine housing down there on the base. And they came in, you know, and ice picked his family, and they were chanting acid is groovy and all that kind of stuff like that. But he was accused of the murders ultimately. You know, first he was accused and they acquitted him, but then he was accused in civil court, in civilian court. And he's in prison right now for many, many years. And that's a whole interesting case as well, because Colonel Aquino was stationed on that base when it happened. And the defense theory – well, you know, at one point the defense theory when Gunderson was running the show was that the defense theory was that it was a satanic cult that came in and killed the family. And so Gunderson found a witness in that who was called Shapley, the girl with the floppy hat, who was chanting acid is groovy. He found that witness who confessed to everything, being involved in his murder. And he controlled that witness throughout the whole situation down there. Then if you go on YouTube, you can find all kinds of speeches that Ted Gunderson used to give in these church basements and stuff about satanic ritual abuse and different kind of shows like that he did. And he was involved with McMartin Preschool, which I'm working on right now, by the way. I'm taking a trip Saturday to California to pull up some serious evidence on that, man. I think I'm going to break this thing wide open. But anyway, so that was the whole thing. Ted Gunderson, he's a well-known guy in these circles. I first came into contact with Gunderson when I was working for as an information broker. I was working for this company that he used to purchase information from, and they were having their problems. This company was having their problems. They ultimately had major problems where they were put out of business because of some information that they bought and sold involving Carly Fiorini, the woman who ran HP. HP. She ran HP, and then she just ran for president recently, Carly Fiorini.
Yeah.
So they had her phone records, and they were selling her phone records and stuff like that to these PIs, and they got in trouble, got put out of business. But before that, they were having their trouble, and one of their employees had the list of all their clients, and he came to me and says, hey, you know, hey, look at, here's the list. So I saw Ted Gunderson on there. He's one of the people I called on the list, offering him my services. So he and I went back and forth over the years. And different cases, different things like that. He was involved in a case here. I was involved in here in Los Angeles. So we knew each other and we were friendly. I respected him. I always respected him. I thought he was, you know, he was a legendary guy, FBI, you know, all this kind of stuff. Jeff McDonald, you know, I knew who he was. So I called him up to help negotiate a settlement in his Art Bell lawsuit. with Bell.
What did he say on the shortwave show?
He said the guest he had on with him said something about, oh yeah, that Art Bell, he's involved in pedophilia, and supposedly, Gunderson said, yeah, we know all about that, you know. So I figured I was on a roll. I settled the thing with who's that guy, right? With the Oates.
Right.
Yeah, I settled the thing with Oates. So I figured, let me call what's the other guy? Let me call Gunderson. Boy, okay.
It's like a tangled web. It can get confusing at times.
Yeah, I know. When I got my daughter texting me here too. But what do you call it? So I called Gunderson. And I says, hey man, what's going on with this lawsuit with Bell? I says, I just settled a lawsuit with him, you know. And I says, you and Bell would get along great. You guys would get along great if you just talked to each other. He goes, Ed, I'm not worried about that at all. He goes, my insurance company's handling that whole thing. My errors and omissions insurance is handling the whole thing for me. So I don't have to worry about anything. And they got the lawyers. They're doing everything. So I said, okay, all right. So then after because Gunderson lost that suit, his insurance company paid off. And I talked to him again after that about something else, but we brought this up. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, I wish they never settled. You know, what the hell was going on? I should have took a more proactive stance in the whole thing. But he told me that his errors, his PI insurance, his private investigator's insurance, called errors and omissions. Now, I have errors and omissions insurance, and I did at the time, but I wasn't involved in radio at the time. And if I make a mistake, if a client hires me, and they says, hey, Joe Gazebo, do an investigation on him, right? And I can't find your criminal record, okay? And then he hires you, and then you steal from the company. And he says, hey, Ed, you omitted this from your report. You didn't find this. And we're suing you for everything we lost because we hired him on your say-so there. My insurance company would step in and because I omitted that from my report. Or I made an error. I said, you did have a criminal record when you didn't. Now Joe Gazebo's suing me, okay, because I'm lying about him. So you have this insurance. But what I didn't know at the time is that errors and omissions insurance is not going to cover anything you say on the radio. No way, no how. And I've checked this out backwards and forwards. Different companies, the whole thing. Is there any way to sneak it in? Because if you're a podcaster or you're doing a radio show or a shortwave show like Ted was, your homeowner's insurance can cover that. If you tell them, hey, I work from home and I do this business at home and I'm on the radio at home. Stuart, what's his name? Webster Tarpley just found that out because he was able to use his home insurance when Trump sued him. So it wasn't his errors and omissions insurance that got him, that represented him in that case. Now, I bring this up because I had another person right before Ted's death. I had a client in California. Totally unrelated case. She wasn't into all this stuff, satanic ritual abuse or radio shows or alt media. She wasn't into any of this kind of stuff. But she told me, she says, you know, I was down at the FBI headquarters down in Los Angeles, and I ran into Ted Gunderson. And I says, well, what was Ted Gunderson doing there? And she says, he was working there. So Ted, the COINTELPRO guy, that's what this guy did. He was COINTELPRO when he worked for the FBI. Then he kind of was this kind of the controller of this satanic witness in the McDonald case, and where Michael Aquino was stationed on that base was also still, or left the FBI and went back as some kind of consultant or whatever, I don't know, but was still working at the FBI headquarters right before his death. Now, I bring this up because I was also told, I'm working on a McMartin thing right now, but in around 97, I contacted one of the mothers in the McMartin preschool case.
Was it Jackie McGully?
Yes, it was. Yeah, Jackie. And I got her on the phone, and and we were talking about this and that. And at the time, I respected Ted, you know, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I know Ted. You know, we were talking because she was living with Ted. They were living together. But they had a falling out. And she was upset, too, that Ted was selling the archaeologist report that she had paid for. But she was upset about a lot of things. And she mentioned to me on the phone, she says, well, you know, Ted calls Michael Aquino. They talk on his cell phone every single day. And I said, well, why would he be talking to Michael Aquino? And why every day? And she said to me, well, to make himself feel important. That's why he does it. which at the time I just took it on face value. I said, okay, but now we hear all these other allegations about Ted being a gatekeeper, you know, people in the Franklin cover-up all think he's a, you know, and so who knows. But then you have this other group who said, you know, he's being he was poisoned with arsenic, all this kind of, I don't know. But I can only tell you my personal experience with Ted Gunderson, and that was it. And so I went to him and tried to get him to settle with Bell, too, and I failed in that regard. but anyway, that's my experience with Ted Gunderson.
Yeah. My only reservation about Ted Gunderson is it seemed like he would latch on to any sort of bizarre case that came about. I know he was involved in the David Carradine thing, and also I think he was a bit of a wingnut when it came to his right wing thinking. You know, if you take out all the satanic stuff, a lot of times he's just like, he sounds like a Rush Limbaugh character with his like, the dirty hippies.
Right, exactly, and he defended his stuff he did against the Black Panthers. He thought he had did the patriotic duty with that. Now, one more thing too with Gunderson is way back when I started the whole email revealer website, and just by total coincidence, you know, people who were high profile people feuding with Gunderson online, you know, had become clients of Email Revealer. So I was kind of aware of the whole controversy behind the scenes with Ted back then, even back then. And as far as attaching your name to high-profile cases like a Carradine and stuff, I interviewed Carradine's ex-wife. I had her on the show who wrote that book. But the thing is, you know, that's kind of something you do as a PI or a lawyer. You know, you'll kind of try to insert yourself into high-profile cases to get free publicity. So I can't hold that against them too much. But there was the other thing, too, which in PI circles, in our little email lists and private message boards that go back and forth, is there's something in the PI world with these little old ladies that are lonely. And they, you know, they come to you, they have some kind of wacky complaint or case they're working on or something, and they've got money, you know, but the ethical thing to do is to turn down these cases, you know, and not take their money, you know, and when people get a reputation of taking their money and, you know, there's really nothing you could do from them. They're never satisfied. They could become a nightmare, you know, as a matter of fact. But, you know, some people get a reputation of taking that money. And some people get a reputation, too, of not only just taking that money, but also, too, like having relationships with them and taking them along on stakeouts and stuff. Like, you hear this all the time, you know. And a lot of these women, too, they'll go from one PI to the next. And they'll say, oh, yeah, the last PI, he took me out on a surveillance with him one night, you know. Like, what? What? Are you kidding me? So there was a lot of that around Ted, too. But, you know, listen, a lot of guys do that.
Yeah, and I wanted to clear one thing up because I'd heard it from a few sources, was that I think Jackie McGauley was upset because she felt that Ted had sort of sensationalized some things in the McMartin case. Am I wrong about that? Or
I don't know. That okay. I don't know about. I had one phone call with McGauley, which was a very pleasant phone call. She thought she saw me posting online, and she thought I was Michael Constantine. And she says, hey, is that you? You know,
Alex Constantine or?
Yeah, Alex Constantine, yeah. She thought I was him. And so we were going back and forth. And I said, no, I'm not Alex Constantine. No, I'm Ed Opperman, you know. And then she gave me her phone number. And that's how I wound up calling her up. And she was going out on a date in a couple hours. She kept mentioning, well, I have a date. I have to get ready for this date. So it was a short conversation, maybe a half hour, 45 minutes. And so nothing about sensationalizing the case. But more recently, because, you know, Stu Webb said she was dead. I wanted to get a hold of her. And Stu Webb said she was dead. But I located her. I found
Stu Webb's quite a character, too. I think he's from your neck of the woods in Nevada.
I don't know where he is. I don't think he's in Nevada right now. I think he's like in Missouri or something like that. I think he's like off the radar. I think we talked about this last time. I think he's just dropped off the radar. He's doing nothing now. But, you know, he has a lot to say about Ted. He had his falling out with Ted. I got a great show I did with Doug Millar where he talks about the fallout with Stu Webb and Ted Gunderson, where Stu Webb was living with Gunderson in an apartment here in Vegas in a condo, and Stu Webb climbed up into the terrace into the apartment to get some boxes. And there was a guy who, there was some noise out in the hallway. So another guy that was living there with Ted went out in his boxer trunks into the hallway, and Stuart pushed him out the door and locked the door and then took all these boxes. It's the craziest story you ever heard in your life. All these people couch surfing each other's houses and all stuff with stinger missiles. You know, you hear all these crazy stories. Like, how he got away with all this stuff, I don't know. Because even with the, we had a little case we worked on here together here. I had a very small part of, you know, he was always under scrutiny. So I don't know, man. I don't know. I can't, people either love him or they hate him. I can only tell you what my experience was with him was. And firsthand that he told me his errors and omissions insurance was paying for that lawsuit. And I know that's impossible. And firsthand that someone saw him working at the FBI office right before he died.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, that's stuff I can testify to in court.
Yeah, yeah. I mean that whole I would suggest readers read up on Ted Gunderson, Stu Webb, all these characters, because regardless of what the truth is, it's definitely entertaining at times to hear some of the stories.
Yeah, no, it is. And if you listen to that show, like I said, with Doug Millar, it's in the member section. It's a funny story, climbing up into the balcony, you know, and pushing this guy out in his underwear, you know. And then he took all these boxes of evidence, you know. But, you know, who knows if that's true either, you know, who knows with this bunch. You know, they all love to sensationalize, and, you know.
Well, I wanted to back up a little bit. Before you got involved in a lot of this PI work, you even have, like, a sort of storied life before that. You owned a nightclub for a while, I believe, right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
And then you also were involved with the Yippies. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, if you notice, it's all the same kind of theme, you know? It's like, same kind of, you know, skullduggery, you know, and organized crime characters, you know, all the same kind of theme throughout my whole life. I got involved with – it all started out. You know, I was a marijuana enthusiast in high school, you know, and I heard about National Marijuana Day. So I went down to Yippie headquarters, you know, and I hooked up with them. And it just blew my mind. I was like, you know, it's like 1977, 1976. And they were talking about the Trilateral Commission, you know, and all this kind of stuff that I'd never heard before, and multinational corporations and Global 2000. And I had this newspaper, Yipster Times, you know, and they knew the guys from MOVE, you know, who got blown up in that building down there.
Yeah.
Some of those guys before they died, because there was another attack in there. They had a house, a freestanding house, where they were attacked, and they had a shootout with the cops. And they were at Yippie. I met them there. So, you know, it was just a fascinating place to hang out. Tiny Tim, you know, was hanging out there. And what was the other guy? Allen Ginsberg, you know. It was just a wild place, you know, right around the corner from CBGB's, you know. Great time in New York City, 70s punk movement and stuff like that. So I became a political activist and a street activist and an anarchist, you know. And that was my – and also, too, there was a lot of COINTELPRO infiltration. I met a guy from the Rainbow family who was one of the big shots in the Rainbow family, and it came out that he was on the payroll of the KGB. You know, someone accused him and says, what do you expect? He's getting paid by the KGB. So I pulled him aside privately and I says, hey, you know, they're saying you get paid by the KGB. And he goes, no. I get a stipend from the Russian consulate for my poetry. The guy couldn't even write a, you know, Hickory Dickory Dock. The guy couldn't write a poet. His life depended on it. But he's telling me he gets a stipend from the Russian embassy. So it was this whole kind of skullduggery and agents and informants, the people from High Times magazine and stuff. It was this weird and ensemble of folks, the Yippies and my political activism career. Al Sharpton, you know, when he was just a young guy. Great time, you know, great time in my life, and I learned a lot, you know. WBAI, the radio station I worked down there, this leftist station in New York City. So, you know, it was a great time. But and that's, they also had the phone freaks, you know, and Captain Crunch, and all, and they knew how to get free phone service and all kinds of stuff too. So I was on the cutting edge of all that stuff as well, so looking over our backs, FBI surveillance. So that was a good proving ground to get into PI work, you know, to be comfortable around that kind of activity, people with criminal cases, you know. And so then I got into the PI work, and then worked on some big organized crime cases, the Commission case and the Pizza Connection case and the Carmine Persico case, a lot of big organized crime cases, because the office I worked out of, that was mostly organized crime stuff. Used to do those bug sweeps, you know, used to send me into attics and stuff like that with the bug detectors crawling around there. Then I left that. I went to the nightclub business. I was involved in a lot of stuff. I mean, who'll be kidding, right?
A New Yorker, so.
Yeah. Out there doing a lot of stuff. And I went to the nightclub business for a while, and then that, we got evicted from the space. That didn't go too well. I ran with the Bulls in Spain, you know, and a very, very interesting life, you know. I call it in my book, I wrote a book called How to Become a Successful Private Investigator, and I had an unfortunate brush with the law, okay, where I was found in a truck in Arizona with 1,000 pounds of marijuana, okay, but you know, ultimately we resolved all that favorably in my favor. So I've had a lot of adventures in my life, you know, like I said, running with the Bulls in Spain, you know, smuggling, you know, nightclub, you know, organized crime, the yippies, you know, well, a lot of fun stuff. When you look back at it, you know, when you have to live and do this stuff, we have to live through this stuff. It's not that much fun, you know, but looking back, it's kind of fun.
Did you ever get to meet the great yippie Abbie Hoffman?
Yes, I did. I met Abbie Hoffman. I was there the day he was turning himself in, you know, at Yippie headquarters, and all the media was swarmed. The whole street was swarmed with media out in front of our headquarters there. And it was funny. The guy who was the Yippie spokesman, I says, "Well, aren't you going to go out there?" He goes, "No, no, no. I'm not talking to them. I'm not talking to anybody." A guy named Fred Gottbetter, one of the coolest people I've ever met in my life. But then later on, when I was working at WBAI, I had done some volunteer work or something like that, or won a contest or whatever it was, an autographed copy of Abbie Hoffman's book, Steal This Book, which I still have, which is a great book. I recommend it to anybody. You'll learn a lot of life hacks through there. And he autographed the book for me. I met him then, and then later on, and he didn't seem so bad at that point. He seemed like a decent guy. But later on, it was an event for the New York Public Interest Research Group, which was a NYPIRG, which was an environmental group. And he was doing an appearance there. And he was just a difficult guy. He was he wanted to argue with everybody. You couldn't agree with Abbie Hoffman. Okay, at that point.
Wasn't there that incident where the guy from, I forget which band it was, the Who or the Kinks, like hit him with a guitar at like Woodstock?
I don't know about that. But I knew Wavy Gravy, the guy from Woodstock. I met him a few times.
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
Yeah. Headquarters, yeah. But Abbie at the end, he just wanted to, he was a bitter guy arguing there, but he had that thing with the seasonal depression, you know, and he was chopping up painkillers and snorting painkillers right in front of everybody. You know, he was out there at the end, you know, and it was sad because the guy was a hero, you know, he was my hero growing up.
Yeah. And you also, I guess, are sort of friends with one of the unheralded yippies, A.J. Weberman. Could you tell us a little bit about A.J.? You've had him on the show a few times.
I had him on the show a few times, which was really, you know, because growing up, you know, like 16, 17 years old, you know, and I knew, you know, A.J. was a legend, you know, and people would say, see that guy? He wrote that book, Coup d'Etat in America, you know, and he came up with the whole theory about the three tramps, you know, being the Watergate burglars. He sued the Watergate burglars back and forth, you know. Fascinating. He was a garbologist, Dylanologist, fascinating guy.
Could you tell us a little bit about, like, what is the Dylanology thing about?
He used to decipher. He still does. He thinks he can decode Dylan's lyrics, and he's a little obsessed with that. He was also head of the Jewish Defense Organization, too.
The Jewish Defense League, yeah.
No, not the league. No, the organization.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The JDO, which were at war with the JDL. As a matter of fact, he lived right across the street from Studio 9, from 9 Bleecker Street, which was Yippie headquarters. Across the street, we had a nightclub called Studio 10, and he lived upstairs of Studio 10. So he had, in the lobby of his building, he had it rigged with tear gas that if someone came into the building he didn't like, he could lock the doors and spray with tear gas, right? So these guys come, and he kind of denies the story now, man, but these guys came who were from the JDL trying to serve him with these papers. And he locked him in and sprayed him, and he was holding him hostage. And it was a hostage standoff going on for like 12 hours or something like that. So that was a whole fascinating. And no one got arrested. I don't know. He did some prison time, too. But and AJ, too, he used to get the hash and the pot and stuff like that from Richard Stratton, the hippie mafia.
Yes. Yeah, I know about Richard Stratton. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, cool. Yeah. See, I never met Richard Stratton back then. Maybe I saw him around, but I didn't know it was him. But I used to get my hash and my pot from through Richard Stratton, through AJ, through Fred, through me, you know, and then I would distribute all over Staten Island. I was known as Eddie from Staten Island back in those days, in my yippie days. That's how I was known.
Didn't AJ also get like a restraining order too from like Bob Dylan because he was like collecting Bob Dylan's garbage or something?
He invented garbology, where he would go steal people's garbage, which today is a tried and true investigative technique. Even with the online bill paying and even with the shredders, it's still a great way to do intel on people. So he invented that, man. AJ is a serious guy, man. A serious researcher, wrote the JFK books, knows everybody involved in the JFK assassination. He knows Marita Lorenz. They have Thanksgiving dinner together. He just testified before the Portugal Parliament. Like, as much as like a colorful character he was, he knew John Lennon. He hung out with John Lennon and Yoko Ono on their bed, eating fried chicken on their bed in the Dakota. So fascinating guy. And a hero of mine, I looked up to him, respected him again, you know. Today, he's kind of a racist, you know. He says some stuff, you know, about blacks and about Barack Obama, you know. I asked him at the end of our interview, one of our interviews, I said, you know, do you have any regrets? And he goes, yeah, supporting Obama. And he says, well, he's anti-Jew. And I said, so I love him. And I'd give him a show, too. But then I think, well, you know, do I really want this AJ today to be the legacy, you know, of the AJ that I knew growing up, you know, and was a hero to so many people, you know? You know, because the guy was out, you know, this guy was on the front lines, man. Serious guy.
He was also on to things often before other people were. I never got the impression he was racist. Actually, I was thinking about him recently when Ron Paul is back in the news after some meme that referred to cultural Marxism and sort of had these like offensive pictures of Jews and blacks. And AJ was one of the first people to call Ron Paul out for, you know, racism.
Yeah, he's the one who found the stuff about Trump's father being in the KKK.
Yep.
You know? Yeah, no, he's still on the cutting edge, man. The guy still, his research is excellent, you know? And I love him, you know, and I respect him. The guy's a hero, you know? And you can, you know, and you can, he still treats me like a kid when we're on the phone. All right, Ed, I gotta go. You know what I mean? And, you know, I still treat people like a kid, too, you know, that I'm 40 years old and I knew when they were a kid. So in some ways, you know, what I got to respect that, you know. I don't know. He was my boss, you know. He's my superior. And I still got to respect that. In a lot of ways, a good soldier still.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I like AJ a lot from what I've seen of him online. He's on Facebook occasionally. He's an interesting guy, you know.
You can't take that away from him. The guy's led a life, man. He's lived a life, man, and you know, he's out there.
Well, I think this is a good way to segue into another topic. You know, you were talking about hanging out with people like Ted Gunderson and Art Bell earlier, but yeah. You're also a guy that hung out with the Yippies. Some of my listeners may be confused because, you know, some of the people would say, oh, that Ted Gunderson and Art Bell, they were kind of right wing nuts, right? But you're hanging out with the Yippies, and you also you're a self-described socialist.
Yeah, I have no problem doing business with anybody. I don't hold anything, bikers, or church. You know, I'm a born again Christian too as well. I was an evangelist. I traveled a tent ministry for 6 years. You know, I respect everybody as they come to me. You know, if we have differing opinions, I have no problem with that. I never got into politics with Bell at all. I did with Gunderson because I said, hey, how can you be out there doing dirty on the Black Panthers? You know. So we disagreed on that. Even though I was trying to get his business, I wanted money from him, you know, and do business with him. But yeah, I'm a socialist, you know, I'm a real socialist, and I just got some real grief about this. I did this interview the other day and forget it. The whole audience doesn't seem to understand, where I am. I'm not a Democrat. You know, I'm a socialist. Those are capitalists. You know, I'm a socialist. I believe in workers' rights. That the worker should keep 100% of their fruit of their labor. That if a worker is working for a company, you know, he should receive all of the fruit of his labor, you know, in proportion. You know, of course, managers would make less than, you know, the guy cleaning the toilet, but, you know, everyone would earn instead of people who aren't working for that company, but hold a piece of paper in their hand and claim that they own a share of that company and can somehow reap rewards and income from that piece of paper in their hand. Like a capitalist will hold a piece of paper saying, I own part of that company, so even though I'm not going to show up for work every day, I'm going to get some of the profit from that company. And I say, no, those who work shall eat. And then capitalists can go back and eat that piece of paper. How's that? Okay? And the workers shall keep the fruit of their labor and keep all their money. And I can't see how anybody can disagree with that.
Yeah, and you actually did an interview recently with a guy calling himself like Joe Sixpack.
Yeah.
He had a book called Socialism Sucks. You sort of took him to task, or tried to, you know?
Well, I like the guy. He's a nice guy, and I think I pretty much ate him alive. But yeah, what are you going to say? And then I did a whole commentary after it, too, where I really go into depth and I explain my beliefs and my theories in socialism and nationalizing the oil industry, you know, which is, you know, oil is under your feet. It's under my feet. We own it equally, and it blows. It's a national resource. It's a natural resource, but it's also a national resource that we all own equally, and other countries nationalize it. And they share the profits from that industry with the people. You know, in some countries they have a retirement account you get when you retire from the oil, from the sale of oil, from under the ground, from under all of our feet equally. You know, makes perfect sense to me. And if we could nationalize any of the profits that are made in the oil industry, if we could nationalize it and reduce the price of oil and gasoline to what, like 50 cents a gallon we can knock it down to? It would spur the greatest economic stimulus in the history of mankind. And then if we could just force the top 1% to pay their fair share of taxes, if they would just pay what you and I are paying right now in taxes, percentage-wise, the rest of us could pay no tax. And it would still double the revenue each year. So again, you and I would have double the amount of money in our pocket. The National Reserve would, we get double the income. And again, the greatest economic stimulus in the history of mankind.
Yeah, and it's crazy too, because like one of the things I've seen you get at when talking about socialism is, you know, people complain about those who are on welfare and say that they're free riding, but they never think about how the capitalists free ride off the laborers.
Exactly right, which is why I try and make that point. Like, why would you let these lazy, morbidly rich people, you know, leech off of us, you know, and not work? Like the Walton family, the six members of this family never worked a day in their life, never created a single job in their life. Or actually, one of them is guilty of murder, a drunk driving murder where she killed somebody, and she's walking around free with her murder erased from her criminal record. You got these six people, never worked a day in their life, and plus they get tax subsidies, and we're paying for their payroll through food stamps and stuff like that, because they don't even pay their workers a decent wage. And these people today possess 40% of this country's assets. If you and me and A.J. Weberman and Ron Paul, we all took our little pennies and our nickels and our dimes and our car deeds and our titles to our apartment, all this stuff, and we put it in a big pile. 175,000 of us would be equal to the pile that those six members of the Walton family could put together. Six people equal 175 people in wealth. Now, if you had another situation, you know, where people were hoarding money like that, if it was a person who was morbidly obese, hoarding animals or hoarding newspapers in their home, and they were morbidly obese, we would cut a hole in the side of their house and pull them out of there, send the EMS and the fire department over there to rescue them. Okay? But in this situation, we let these six folks, and we reward them. We look at them like heroes, like they're royalty or something. They're greater than us, than you and me, and they deserve more than you and me somehow, you know. Some of the sickness that we have, the worshiping these obscenely rich, and just for their own good and for the good of the country, we need to put a stop to that, okay? And I would nationalize Walmart, too, as well. And that's another thing that could be nationalized easily without any fear of running the business into the ground.
Well, that's one of the other things I like about the Opperman report. You know, you come at things from a more politically left perspective. You talked about how the DNC screwed over Bernie. You've talked about all this stuff. You're a far cry from, you know, these clowns like Alex Jones, who was just, you know, saying that there was going to be a civil war starting, you know, on July 4th. I guess he was wrong about that. You know, you're a good antidote to the lesser, more sensationalistic voices in the alternative media, so-called.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I wish that people weren't so programmed, like Pavlov's dog, that when they hear socialists, they wouldn't immediately jump, you know, to all these conclusions about, you know, welfare, you know, giving away money to people who don't want to work, when it's the exact opposite. You know, and if they would just stop and listen, you know, because then it really, you know, another thing too, because I just had this whole big controversy on this other show I just did where I'm being tarred and feathered for being a socialist. I forgot what I was going to say. Sorry.
Well, you said you were getting tarred and feathered for a show you were doing, or?
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say is when people hear that I'm a socialist, instead of actually hearing what I'm trying to say about it, and here it is. Here's what I'm going to say. The same folks who think that the news media is lying to them about everything. They're lying to them about Trump, and it's all controlled, and the mainstream media is controlled by the Jews and all that kind of stuff, you know, and it can't be trusted. But the one time they'll believe them is when the mainstream media, which is owned by, you know, the biggest corporations in the world, tells them that socialism doesn't work, and socialism will never work, and socialism is bad for them somehow. Okay, that's the only thing time they'll ever believe them, when because they think that they have something in their interests. You know what I mean? And by the way, to this whole thing, everyone right away, I start getting called a Jew and, you know, a globalist. Whatever. I'm Christian. I'm not a Jewish. I'm not Jewish. Okay, I'm Christian. So that's a whole other thing there.
Yeah, and you know, the stuff with Alex Jones is just, I don't know. It seems like, this is a guy that was on KLBJ Radio, which is owned by Sinclair Broadcasting. I don't see why we should trust guys like him, or even, you know, I'm very skeptical of Roger Stone in a lot of ways. Now they're telling us to trust Trump. It just seems like a lot of hooey to me.
Well, you know, interesting. Roger Stone also was the manager for Al Sharpton when Al Sharpton ran for president and ran for mayor and stuff like that in New York City. And Al Sharpton pretty much comes right out and says, yeah, you know, he was just doing that to split the Democratic votes to put in Republicans in office. So, yeah, Stone, I respect Stone for what he's doing. You know, I'm kind of good friends with St. John Hunt.
E. Howard Hunt's son, yeah.
Right, and he works for Stone now. He's a writer for Stone. And in fact, when the new book came out, that was the first show that Hunt did about the new book. I forget what it's called. But it's the one that just came out. And, you know, we talked about all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes with the whole Mueller investigation. So, you know, by the way, too, I'm kind of involved in that. I can say this. This is what I can say. I just got permission to say that I was the investigator in some civil litigation against Donald Trump in 2016. So people have to figure out which one it is. Okay. But in the course of that litigation, and as you know, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, if we've talked about this before, is I'm the investigator for Keith Daniels. I'm one of the main investigators he uses. In fact, I'm the guy he comes to when he's in trouble. And, you know, Keith Davidson is the attorney for Stormy Daniels. He was the first attorney that cut the deal with Stormy Daniels and cut all those deals back and forth with Michael Cohen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's my lawyer. When I have a client, that's who I send them to. And when Keith's in trouble, he hires me. He brings me into – I just worked for him the other day. And the other one involved in all that is Gina Rodriguez, who used to be my agent, who was the agent also, too, for Stormy Daniels. So me and her, we have fallen out here and there, but we still love each other. And so I'm going to be in those Michael Cohen texts and those Michael Cohen emails and stuff like that. My name's going to be in there. My address is going to be in there. I actually believe that it could come out that some threats that were made against me back in 2016, some very serious threats, could come out in all this as well. So there's that.
Well, that's a bombshell that people are going to have to look out for. This Stormy Daniels case is really interesting. It's not surprising, but it's really interesting.
It is very interesting. And the part that I find the most interesting about it is if people would only realize that the folks who took down Trump in this, Keith Davidson and Gina Rodriguez, who were there at the beginning, who ran this whole thing. And by the way, I was talking about this back in 2016. I knew all about this, this porn star that was getting paid off by Trump. And that the tabloids were running interference for Trump. I talked about this way back in 2016. But Gina Rodriguez was the and Keith Davidson were the same people behind the Wienergate. Did you know that?
No, I didn't realize that. Yeah, Anthony Weiner, yeah.
People have no clue. You know, I worked on Wienergate too. I did the phones in Wienergate too. I did the cell phone forensics and that. I pulled out the picture of that girl Maria here in Las Vegas. But. Yeah, so it's not politically – those two are money motivated. They're not politically motivated. I'm politically motivated, but I'm also money motivated too as well. You know, I want to make money. So the same people behind Wienergate to take down Clinton's buddy there, Anthony Weiner, Uma's husband, are the ones who went down and took down Trump. They were also involved in the Charlie Sheen case, the Tiger Woods case, all that stuff. This is that same group that did this.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. People have no idea. And also, too, you know who Gina Rodriguez was, just did that TV series. She was the executive producer of it. She did the Lie Detector TV show, too. She booked everybody on Dr. Drew. She booked me on Dr. Drew. She used to book the people on Dr. Drew rehab thing. He did that celebrity rehab. She was behind the Mama June from Not to Hot. Honey Boo Boo's mother just did that makeover thing. Yeah, that was Gina. So, and that was going on while Gina Rodriguez, and I hate to keep mentioning her name because I'll hear from her, she'll call up screaming at me. But while that was going, she's there with Mama June doing that, you know, that whole farce. At the same time, they're negotiating with Trump, getting a payoff from Trump. This is what's going on. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's just fascinating.
Well, I kind of like how Stormy Daniels has dealt with this whole thing where, you know, all the Trumpkins are like, you're just doing it for the money. You're a porn star. She's like, yeah, I am doing it for the money. I think it'll make a good biopic one day. You know, she doesn't care in the same way that Trump doesn't care. And that's the only thing that will drive these Trumpkins nuts.
Well, you know, Gina was a porn star, too. She was Demi Delia.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So there's a thread running through all this, if you notice.
Well, you were didn't you tell me last time that you were involved with the Alexis Capri Charlie Sheen case? Could you talk like briefly about that?
Alexis Capri, that wasn't her name. Capri Anderson was her name, but she had,
She went. I think she went by both names at one point, but Capri Anderson, yeah.
Yeah, I only knew Capri Anderson, but and she has a real name too, but I don't remember what it is. And what happened was with that was. Keith Davidson was involved in that too. I don't know if I can talk about everything with that, but what happened with that was she was attacked by Charlie Sheen. I believe that whole – anyway, I can't get into that. But she was attacked by Charlie Sheen in the Plaza Hotel in New York City. And when the cops came, which has not been reported in the press, I don't think at all, she was hiding in the bathroom. It's a little girl too, by the way. She's like 99 pounds.
Yeah, real petite little girl. I felt bad when I heard about that story.
Yeah, and Charlie Sheen, by the way, he was out on probation for pulling a knife on his wife on Thanksgiving Day over there in Colorado. Was covered in blood, his own blood, because he had broken all his glass and stuff like that. When the cops came in, he was naked, head to toe, covered in blood. You know, like smeared all over his body. And no one talks about that. So she was terrified. And so then he tried to sue her, you know, and stuff like that. And Keith represented her. And I got involved in that, pulling up some text messages about how he was offering her money and stuff like that. So that was pretty much my involvement in that as far as what I could talk about.
Okay. Yeah, well, I wanted to bring it up just because I mean, that's the type of people Alex Jones, I guess, hangs out with. And it seemed like an interesting little story. You know, you've been involved in all these, like, really crazy high-profile cases. It's fascinating.
Well, you know, also, too, I did some shows on Jones, too, and I tried to book his wife, his ex-wife, to come on my show. She turned out to be a...
Yes, I've dealt with Kelly through email a few times. It's hard getting her on at times.
She's impossible. So, anyway, forget it. So, but I've done shows about Jones too, and his background and his shadiness, you know, his court lawsuits with his ex-wife and stuff like that, where he said, you know, it's all performance art. He's not really involved in, you know, his Sandy Hook lawsuit and stuff like that. So yeah, Jones, I have no respect for him whatsoever. And I know people who knew him too in the radio business that worked with him in Austin when he was down in Austin down there. You know, he got into a fight with some guy and called the cops and stuff. You know, it's the wacky guy, man, and in a lot of different ways. And definitely on the payroll. This guy's making, what, $4 million a month or something like that, selling his
super male vitality pills.
Yeah, yeah. And I love how he says, I got together with some scientists and we invented this. I love this guy. No shame, you know. And by the way, I totally missed this whole July 4th revolution, that the Democrats are going to have a revolution against other capitalists and Republicans. Yeah, that's likely to happen.
Because of George Soros. It's all George Soros.
That's a whole nother one. You know, I've done a lot of looking. Hey, I can't really find the what's the – first of all, hey, listen, I know Black Lives Matter here locally. I know all these leftist groups here. So none of them are getting any money from Soros. I can tell you that for a fact. I can say 100% for a fact. But although we did have a protest here, a Never Trump protest that was run by MoveOn.org that was totally totally a shill operation, man. They just came into town and didn't even contact any of the local activists or anything like that. It was a total setup. And it was even some weird, suspicious stuff that was going on, too, where some armed Trump supporters showed up. You know, that we think there was going to be a staged event. And also, too, what happened was there was definitely a staged event with that, too, where the cops helped the protesters block off the street so that they could do a sit-in in the middle of the street, which we would never happen for real, not a real protest. And one of the casinos, too, it let them use a parking lot for free and gave them bottled water. So that was a staged event here. And then at the event, I didn't actually go to it, but I had friends who went down and watched it. After the event was over, they had some staged photos of people holding signs that said, "I'm with her," you know, that they inserted into the story of, but no one actually saw these people there at the protest. So that was a MoveOn.org hijacked event that was totally staged. And I was, I got some interviews I did too with the organizers of it, where they pretty much they admitted they weren't allowed to talk to me anymore because they were getting in trouble for talking to me. So that's a whole thing there too, yeah.
Well, I wanna wrap up talking a little bit about some of your greatest hits in terms of interviews. You just had, I mean, you've had some incredible finds. You just had Madonna Wallen on, Natasha Kernett's mother. Could you tell us about that interview? What's that episode about? It's a true crime one.
Yeah, I stumbled on this whole thing with Natasha Kernett, who was this Satanist who was married at 17 years old to a guy in the Church of Satan, had a satanic Bible, you know, all this stuff. And they were doing satanic blood rituals in her bedroom as a teenager and stuff like that. And she teams up with this group of goth kids, vampires, the Satanists as well. They hop in a car to go down to New Orleans because they were fascinated with Anne Rice. They run into a family with a minivan, and they wind up killing his family. Horrific murders with it. And it was a ritualistic murder too, where they shot them with triangles in their chest, and he had just done a blood sacrifice ritual thing in a motel room the night before with triangles as well. And they kept mementos from the family. Each one had something in their pocket from the family after the sacrifice was done. So it was definitely an occult crime. There's no doubt in my mind of that. So I was trying to do a show about it, and I contacted an author who wrote a book, and she never got back to me. And I just contacted the mother, Kernett's mother, who came on the show. You know, it's a tragic story, and she just kind of pretty much admitted to everything, but then kind of says, "Well, I don't know what they were doing in their room, and I don't know what's going on." You know, and it's a fascinating interview, I think.
Yeah, you have that one. You also did an interview about the London Nil bombing in Britain, which involved neo-Nazis.
Yeah, the guest on that is going to be doing hosting a show on my station, Awake Radio. I'm going to be promoting his stuff. He's doing some pretty good work out there in the UK. And we have a big UK following and an Ireland following too as well. Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that story at all. But this guy was a right-wing guy and definitely the cops knew about him and knew about he was doing these bombings. And they knew his next target was going to be a gay nightclub. So there's no doubt about that. And it was all covered up out there. You don't even hear about the London Nail bombing, you know, as one of these big stories. But he's on the trail on that for sure.
Yeah, you've covered that. You've covered – I'm looking over some stuff. You've done a lot of shows on Corey Feldman. I really recommend those. I don't know if you – have you covered the Allison Mack cult thing yet in Hollywood? I know you cover a lot of the Hollywood sex stuff.
No, is that one, the X-Men thing,
That's Allison Max, the girl from Smallville, and she was part of like a master-slave sex cult led by a guy, and all the women were like sex slaves or some weird stuff.
Very little, but I was able to confirm that for a fact that Stormy Daniels was never involved in that cult. People tried to make the claim that some tattoo she had was involved in that, and I've confirmed that no, she's not. But there's a lot of good stuff in the members section. I did a show about Steve Bannon's Porn and Meth House. That's exclusive. I did a show with them about McMartin Preschool, where I have the geologist who did the original ground penetrating radar, who came on my show exclusively. No one's interviewed this guy in 30, 35 years. No one. I found him. And, what he called, he sent me a document too. It's in the member section. But he talks about how he went there when they raised the building, and underneath the detached garage, he found a hand dug room underneath the garage that exists there. I have another witness I'm working on right now who's going to give me a statement that he also saw that room. And this guy's in a position, a much better position to, his connection to the property is much more significant than we have with Mr. Michaels, who's the geologist. I had Tim Tate, who wrote the who did the film Conspiracy of Silence. Everybody loves to talk about Franklin cover-up and Conspiracy of Silence and how it was banned from the Discovery Channel. I actually have a producer on there who tells the whole story. A lot of good stuff in the member section, man. That I'm McCracken, Brian McCracken. In fact, I'm interviewing him later on today, who was a witness of the Arliss Perry murder. That's in the news right now because they arrested some security guard up there. So I'm going to get him on the show today. I'm going to be interviewing him about what he thinks now with this guy. I think his name is Crawford, the security guard who wrote a confession letter and suicide letter 2 years ago after he was first contacted and had Maury Terry's book in his closet and all kind of stuff like that. I suspect.
Oh, the ultimate evil about the Son of Sam murders. You've covered that a lot too, yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot of Son of Sam stuff. Son of Sam witnesses and Son of Sam victims and people who are shot by Son of Sam. Cult stuff like that, a lot of process stuff, sure.
And one of the members episodes that really impressed me was you had a reporter from Vice on who did a article on Adnan Khashoggi's sex dungeon.
Yep.
You know, and that's the only interview I've ever heard from that reporter about that.
Yeah, you like that, huh? Yeah. But, you know, he contacted me too. He wanted to interview me about something. And he needed some information. I forgot what it was. We never got together. But, yeah, Adnan Khashoggi's a fascinating character, man. Back in the 80s, he used to be on every week on The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous because he was the richest man in the world. They used to call him a Saudi businessman, but he was really an arms dealer, a CIA agent. The Mossad, worked with the Mossad, was involved in Iran-Contra, involved in drug smuggling, had his own island down in the Bahamas with a secret airbase, airstrip down there. Best friends with Donald Trump, lived at Mar-a-Lago there for a while when he was ducking subpoenas. Had one of his prostitutes was Heather Mills, the wife of Paul McCartney. I actually had a long conversation with one of his ex-bodyguards who I tracked down, who wrote an anonymous book about being Adnan Khashoggi's bodyguard. And when I found him and I started talking to him, he freaked out that I was able to find him. He said he was going to come on and do the show. The guy wrote a book. You'd think he'd want some publicity. But he freaked out, man, when I got him on the phone. He said, how did you find me, man? And so that was that. But Adnan Khashoggi is a fascinating character. By the way, Adnan Khashoggi is behind that book, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. He's the
by John Gray. Yeah, yeah. He's sort of a proto Jordan Peterson type character.
Well, John Gray, too, was behind the whole 9/11 the truther guy, too, you know. Very suspicious origins, you know. So, yeah.
One of your other guests, Daniel Hopsicker, who's a great investigative journalist. You've had him on a bunch of times. He's covered all that stuff.
You can't beat Daniel Hopsicker. This guy should have a Pulitzer Prize. His work on the flight schools down there in Florida, the Venice Beach flight schools before 9/11.
And how Muhammad Atta was there, and there was, you know, a DC-9 plane with cocaine, all kinds of really crazy stuff. You think it's crazy at first, but then you really listen to his stories and the journalism he's done. He's very hard-nosed about stuff. Doesn't deal with nonsense.
No, I agree with you 100%. And also, too, you know, he lived with Barry Seal's wife, Barry Seal's widow. He lived down there with them when Barry Seal's son. And he did all that work on Operation 40. He's the one who found that photograph. Everybody talks about Operation 40, of all the Operation 40 assassins down there at that nightclub in Mexico. He's the one who found that photo and identified each person in it. So Daniel Hopsicker has done some legendary work, man, and God bless him. Thank God he loves to come on my show.
Yeah, if anyone has seen that movie with Tom Cruise, American Made, about Barry Seal, Daniel Hopsicker's got the real story on that. He's got the scoop.
Yeah, and also, too, we just did a little segment, too, about Vince Vaughn's mother being involved in one of these hedge funds that was laundering money for these drug dealers. This guy, he knows how to track down laundered money. He knows how to track down these planes. He knows how to do all that stuff. He's really, really sharp with all that kind of stuff. Daniel Hopsicker, great guy.
And are there any other favorite guests you've had on the show or shows you would recommend that listeners – listen to if they're interested in true crime or the conspiracy topics you cover.
Shows I'm really proud of are Richard Lambert, the FBI agent in charge of the anthrax investigation. I'm proud of that show, and we've become friends off the air. He's a cool guy. This guy was briefing the Bush White House every day on anthrax. Who was that guy, Bush's vice president, that worked? Cheney. He was briefing Cheney daily. He said, you know, I think that was a good guest. Ramona Africa, the shows I did on Move, she was one of the survivors that when she tried to escape that burning building, they were shooting at her. She was the only survivor of Move, as a matter of fact, although the last living survivor from that attack, police attack. I'm proud of those shows. Fred Whitehurst, Dr. Fred Whitehurst, the FBI director of forensics, you know, worked on everything. In fact, you know what? I just got contacted by some investigators in the OJ case who wanted a hard copy of that interview because he said something in that interview that's very important evidence in the OJ case. The Steve Bannon porn and meth house, I'm very proud of that. That's exclusive. There's so many, man. I'm really proud of a lot of these shows.
Were there any particular? I know you've covered some mob stuff before. Were there any of those shows you would recommend?
Frank Collada, who was a local gangster who was in, you know, the guy in Casino. He's actually an actor in Casino too, doing all those hits, shooting all those people. He's an interesting guy. I enjoyed those shows. I don't know. Can you think of any other of the mob ones?
The Michael. I don't know how you pronounce his name. Michael Blutrich. He did the the book about owning a strip club, and I think he was involved somehow in the John Gotti story. So I'd recommend that.
Yeah, Mike Blutrich. The Scores. He owns one of the owners of Scores. That's a good show too. I enjoyed that show as well. It's so funny too. Some of these people, you know, the interview is just the start of it, really, and then things go on off the air where I get involved. Like sometimes I get hired, you know, in different cases and stuff from this. So it's fascinating how, you know, like talking to a listener, someone who listens to the shows and what really is going on, the whole big picture behind the scenes. Cynthia McKinney. I enjoyed those shows as well that I did with her.
I think you even had some fun episodes. I think you interviewed someone that was involved with like the burlesque dancing scene at one point.
Probably did. I don't remember that. How about Alan Abell? Remember Alan Abell, the hoaxer from the 70s? I had him on.
Oh, yeah. You've had Sean Atwood on. That's another good one.
He's a good guy, yeah. He's always got good stuff, good content coming out.
Sean, for those that don't know, he had some personal experiences with that. I call him a scumbag, the Arizona Sheriff, Joe Arpaio. So that's a good show.
Sam Kennison's brother, I had him on. David Carradine's ex-wife, I think that's good. You know who I have coming on soon? Gretchen Bonaducci. Danny Bonaducci's ex-wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and you know, my ex-girlfriend went to high school with Danny Bonaducci, so I know some stories that have never made the press. He used to hang out with Michael Jackson and Christian Brando.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, you've covered a lot of that Hollywood stuff. I know you've done shows about John Belushi, and of course you've covered the whole Laurel Canyon weirdness with, you know, the late Dave McGowan.
Yeah, Dave McGowan, you know, people don't really realize this, but if you go back and look at, and I was one of the first guys to really interview Dave McGowan besides Maria Keller. And when I started, even before, you know, the first couple of times I interviewed him, I would mention him. Like when I went on Coast to Coast, I would say, hey, have you heard about this book? We're seeing Syndicate. I'd mention it. So I mentioned him on Coast to Coast before even Dave did Coast to Coast. And then it was funny too, because, I don't know if it's funny, but I needed money. I was short on money, and John B. Wells, producer, contacted me and bought my Rolodex of my guests, the different guests that I had on. So I sold him Dave McGowan's contact information so they could bring Dave McGowan on the show over there too as well. So there's a lot of stuff. Oh, man, there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes with Dave McGowan. It's actually, I had a couple of people involved with my show that were stalking Dave McGowan, who stalked him on his hospital bed in his hospital down there. So it was a lot of skullduggery and intrigue behind the whole Dave McGowan story as well.
He, for my listeners that don't know, Dave McGowan wrote, I mean, it's kind of a conspiratorial take on the Laurel Canyon music scene, where he makes connections between Laurel Canyon and the military industrial complex. He also, in that book, Weird Scenes, I think it's called Weird Scenes in the Canyon.
Yeah, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon.
Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. He does a lot of coverage of the Four on the Floor murders, Wonderland Avenue, which is now a podcast on Hollywood and crime. They're covering that about John Holmes. So, you know, Dave McGowan covered a lot of interesting stuff. I didn't always agree with him, but I loved what he wrote and always told him he was a great writer.
I had Holmes' ex-girlfriend on the show who tells a story about the Four on the Floor and stuff like that. And she was a little girl when he got a hold of her, too. Prostituted and stuff like that. It was a tragic story.
Yeah, Dawn Schiller.
Right, Dawn Schiller, yeah. Also, too, the woman who was raped by who's that guy? Al Sharpton's buddy there, the Godfather of Soul, James Brown.
James Brown. Yeah, yeah.
I had her on. You know how I got the John Holmes show is because I was looking for. I wanted to do a show about Roy Cohen, and I found out that John Holmes used to fly on Roy Cohen's plane and on his yacht. Used to hang out with John Holmes and Roy Cohen, used to hang out together. So that's what got led me on the thing to find Dawn Schiller, who was a.
Doesn't Roy Cohen connect back to Donald Trump? Does everyone connect to Donald Trump?
Yeah, well, Roy Cohen too. You know, I had Jim Rothstein on the show. He's the guy who arrested
NYPD detective. Yeah.
And he investigated the Process Church and stuff like that, and the Son of Sam murders, and he also arrested Frank Sturgis, and Sturgis supposedly confessed to him too about the JFK assassination. But
was Sturgis involved in Sturgis, for my younger listeners, was one of the Watergate plumbers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, wait. I had Frank Sturgis' nephew. This is another show I really like, too. It's a guy because it's an exclusive that nobody else interviews. Jim Hunt is Frank Sturgis' nephew, and he's Frank Sturgis' alibi for the day of the JFK assassination, right? Take that with a grain of salt. Now, I like Jim Hunt very, very much. Cool guy. He's a law professor down in Texas. You know, and Doug Caddy, too, I had on my show, too, who was the first attorney for the Watergate burglars. But Jim Hunt tells me these stories about Frank Sturgis. Frank Sturgis had his own B-25 bomber. He had a bomber jet in his own private hangar in Florida. And he went to, for the mafia, he went to collect on a drug debt from I think it was Haiti, from the president of Haiti, and went down there and bombed the palace in Haiti. Stuff like that, that he and Frank Sturgis were making napalm in their garage with all these young right-wing activists down there. Fascinating stuff about the – and Frank Sturgis, too, fixed – remember Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King, that big tennis match? He had inside information on that and rigged the betting on it. So Frank Sturgis, a lot of fascinating stuff with these characters. And he was also involved in the murder of Che Guevara, too, people may not realize. But a lot of good stuff there, too, as well.
And you've even covered Danny Casolaro and the whole Octopus Promise scandal with Ted Rubenstein, another great researcher.
Yeah, Ted Rubenstein is, again, a legend. He worked with Mae Brussel. He worked with who's that guy? Avery. I forget his name. Emery. Dave Emery.
Oh, Dave Emery. Yeah. Dave Emery's still kicking too. He still does his show every week.
Really? I was unaware of that. And he also worked at the Larry Flynt Publications too. So Rubenstein's a legend, you know, in his own right. Real sober thinker. I'm blessed to have this guy help me out finding guests or giving me advice when I need it. I'm a lucky guy, man. You know, I've caught the attention of a lot of, like Rothmiller, you know, not Rothmiller. Who's that other guy? We've told him before.
The NYPD detective.
No, the guy with the flying circus there, with Muhammad Atta.
Oh, Daniel Hopsicker. Yeah.
Hopsicker, right. See, man, come on. I'm really lucky that these guys like me and respect me, and they'll come on the show and I could, you know, get their attention. They contact me off the air and stuff. Yeah, man, God, you know, this is gold. These people are gold, you know?
I mean, you even had Mark Rudd from the Weather Underground on your show, so.
That was interesting. Mark Rudd, he did a lot of research on me before he did the show. And he was pushing my buttons from the very start. Did you ever listen to that show?
Yes, I did. I enjoyed that show a lot.
Did you? He was pushing my buttons, man, throughout the whole show. Maybe you didn't notice, you know, very clever. And it's kind of, I don't know, man. Because I asked him, did you ever see any infiltration, anybody you thought was FBI undercover and stuff like that? And he said, nope. I said, well, you know, if you look around the room and you don't see anybody, it was the undercover agent, maybe it's you. You know, so that's Mark Rudd, but I had him on the show, yeah. I did shows about, who was that guy? Leonard Peltier. I had his son on the show, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he's rotting away in prison right now. Leonard Peltier, 77 years old, almost 80 years.
The American Indian movement, right?
Yep, yep. Betty Metzger about the burglary, which was about the...
J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
Yeah.
The burglars broke into the FBI headquarters and discovered all those COINTEL program documents. I had the guy who found the Operation Northwoods documents. I had him on the show.
Is that James Bamford? Or
I forget what his name is. He wrote some book about the World War II, which I wasn't really interested in, but I wanted to get him on about the other thing. Samantha Spiegel, who was an interesting character. She was this little girl. She was 9 years old. And John Mark Carr from the JonBenet Ramsey case was her school aide in her school. And then later on, when she became an adult, they got into a relationship. And he tried to brainwash her into helping him kidnap little girls for a sex cult he wanted to form. And she had to get a restraining order against him. Oh, I had the attorney, Robert David Lewis, who did the FOIA request on the boys on the track case. Lynn Ives' son, who was killed down there in Mena, Arkansas.
Yeah, and that supposedly ties into like the Clinton family, yeah.
Exactly. And he did a Freedom of Information Act motion. And if you read that motion, you know, you go online and find that thing, man. That gives the best outline of the whole Mena, Arkansas, Iran-Contra drugs smuggling operation that I've seen anywhere. He really lays it out. And he's an aged attorney, like 77 years old, and he's still working on his case with no help. I tried to hook him up with some people to help him out. Maybe I should get back to work on that. You know, I'm doing the best I can. I had one of Sandusky's victims on, too, this guy, Greg Bucarini. There's also an organized crime type case too as well.
Yeah, and you've covered so much stuff that it's mind-boggling. I mean, you've covered obscure true crime cases like the Carrie Steiner case. You've of course covered Ted Bundy a few times with Kevin M. Sullivan, a great writer.
Another one too. I did a show about Richard Biegenwald, who was a serial killer in New Jersey, and I actually met Biegenwald on Staten Island at his mother's house. I had these marijuana growers from Tennessee. Biegenwald was down in Tennessee, too. He had a connection with these guys. And they used to bring their marijuana from Tennessee to Staten Island. I would help them sell it. And we met them one time at Biegenwald's mother's house. We needed a location to meet these guys. And Biegenwald was this wacky, agitated guy. He pulls out a shotgun and starts waving a shotgun around. And so I wasn't worried, though, because I knew these guys for years. I had my guy Pete with me. No one would mess with me. And as we were leaving, he pointed to this area in the front patio that was like walled in, which is unusual for Staten Island, to have like a little enclosed area in the front of your house. And he says, "This is where we bury the bodies." And, you know, we just thought it was a stupid joke, you know. And it turned out later on that, yeah, they had bodies buried in that house. And I don't even know if they even dug where the spot where he pointed to, because they found bodies in the basement of that house. He was also, he used to make these little gadgets like a cigarette lighter that would shoot a bullet. And he had snakes down there and he was milking them for the poison and stuff. I'm friends with his attorney, Lou Diamond. I've known him for years on Staten Island. I'm trying to book an interview with him. I just haven't gotten around to it. For more on this Biegenwald case, I'd love to do a book on it too, on the Biegenwald case. He told his lawyer, Lou Diamond, Biegenwald did, because he had organized crime connections too as well. And he says, you know those kids on the milk cartons? He goes, a lot of those kids I'm responsible for, that we take them when we sell their organs.
Wow.
Yeah. Ooh. Wow, yeah. You know?
Yeah, that actually leads me to ask one quick question here, and then we'll start wrapping, is what do you think about, you know, the East Area Rapist was recently caught with this new DNA sort of forensic evidence that is now being used to close a lot of cases. You think a lot of cold cases are going to get closed by this kind of new technology?
Yeah, I do. I do. Because, you know, even this, what's that thing you see on TV? Genealogy, you know, the website that genealogy, I forget what it's called.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's like a family tree type website, yeah.
Yeah, watch out for those. They want you to send in your DNA. They sell that DNA to the database, the government databases. I wouldn't get involved with that because who knows what you're going to do later on in life. You never know when the stuff hits the fan. You might have to go out and do something. My God, I don't want my DNA on record. Are you kidding me, man? That's crazy. So, yeah, I warn people again, don't go giving your DNA to these people and selling it. That. And I think, yeah, there's going to be a lot of cases going to be solved. I think as technology moves forward, a lot of old cold cases we're going to see. Like, even just this case right now with the Arliss Perry, you know, with this guy. That's because they found his DNA on the bench, you know, and they wanted to get a sample of his DNA. So he knew it was there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what cases can get closed.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of big famous ones, you know. So
I mean, if we ever catch the Zodiac and find out who that was, that'll be the day.
Yeah, fascinating, right? Because back in those days, you never thought twice about licking an envelope or licking a stamp, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I often wonder maybe this will maybe DNA evidence will finally like bring to justice someone like Robert Durst, who is also, I don't know if you were familiar with him when you were living in New York, but he's sort of become a sort of figure of infamy now.
Yeah, I did a couple of shows on Durst.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, listeners should hear those, too.
Yeah, I did some pretty good shows on Durst. Oh, you know what? Another one, too, I'm really proud of. Sally Miller, who was one of Bill Clinton's ex-girlfriends in Troopergate. And she hadn't done an interview in like 30 years. Because she originally, she didn't go public. She was outed against her will. And so she did very, very few interviews back then and hadn't done an interview in 30 years. And one of my listeners is a librarian and knew Sally Miller and says, hey, you should go on this Ed Opperman show. And she came on the show and she just let loose, man. And she talked about how Hillary Clinton had two abortions before Chelsea while she was married. Aborted two kids while she was married before Chelsea. And I'm driving along in my car and I hear Rush Limbaugh quoting my show and quoting my guest without giving me any credit, you know. And then it got such a big story, too, that the Russian TV, not RT, but real Russian TV, like the Russian MTV, flew to where she lives down in Arkansas there and did an interview with her there in her house. That's a show I'm pretty proud of, too.
Yeah, and the last one I'll recommend for listeners is the you interviewed the director of Who Killed Nancy, the documentary about who really killed the Sex Pistols. Nancy, I forget how you pronounce her last name, Spungen or?
Right. Spungen.
So, Spungen, yeah, yeah, and whether it was really Sid Vicious or if it was someone else. So you've gotten an amazing array of guests.
Yeah, when you look back at it this way, yes, because sometimes I get disappointed. I says, you know, what have I really done? You know, who's really? But it's a lot of good content, a lot of, you know, slosh in between, but you know, a lot of stuff I'm really proud of. I have to admit.
Well, I really want to push my listeners to consider joining your members section. You always have deals going on, correct?
Yeah, especially right now we're trying to raise money. I'm leaving for California. This Sunday morning, I'm going, and we got to go too because my daughter, we're gonna go visit colleges up there as well. But I'm trying to take two trips. One is to work on this McMartin case, and another one is to look into. We're gonna go up to Stanford University too. I have a witness up there I want to talk to about this whole Arliss Perry thing. Which, by the way, you know, it turns out because I found McCracken, nobody interviewed him before either, you know, that I'm kind of like really getting clued into stuff with that as well. So I'm getting a lot of behind the scenes juice there. So if you want to help support this, you can become a member at OppermanReport.com. And there's a lot of great content there, just like Joe says. And I'll give you a deal, 13 months for $60 if you email me at OppermanReport@gmail.com. Otherwise, you could just go to OppermanReport.com and sign up for a monthly or quarterly, whatever. But if you could email me and we do a PayPal quicker, you know, so I get the money fast for this trip. $60 for 13 months. I'll give you a deal.
And it's not just you won't just be getting free shows, I think, or you won't just be getting exclusive shows, I should say. You also have documents and a lot of other exclusive content.
Yeah, the Jeffrey Epstein search warrant videos, the execution of the search warrant, got the videos there. We have a ton of Epstein documents, court lawsuits, exclusively. No one's had it. I'm surprised more people haven't put it up. Is the 24-page letter from Epstein's attorney where he claims that he helped create the Clinton Foundation.
Right, and Jeffrey is the rich billionaire who also was involved with teenage girls.
Yeah.
And Trump's a big fan of him, too. Jeffrey's a wild guy, as he once said. So.
Right, and they're co-defendants in a dissolved lawsuit against the two of them for raping a 13-year-old in 2016.
Well, you've got all the information. You can get all this and more if you contact Ed Opperman at the Opperman Report.
Yeah, thank you so much, Joe.
Is there anything else you want to plug, or?
I just don't want to plug. No, that's about it, man. Let me think. Who do I have coming up? Oh, I'm doing a show with McCracken. Brian McCracken from the Aldous Perry case. I'm doing a show later on today. I'm taping a bunch of shows today with who's that guy? Nathan Forrest Winter, who is a little boy from Clowntown that was raped from the producer, the director of Clowntown.
Oh, Victor Salva, the guy that did Jeepers Creepers. Well, yeah, yeah.
Right, yeah. So I already did a 2-hour show with him. I'm doing an hour with him today because he has a film coming out. And let me tell you something. You got to listen to that show because Francis Ford Coppola is up to his neck in all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Francis Ford Coppola has essentially, it seems like, protected Victor Salva for years. I mean, when Victor Salva couldn't get work, it was Francis Ford Coppola's production company that was making these Jeepers Creepers movies.
Yep. And had him come out of a jail to be at the premiere and stuff like that. It's unbelievable. The stuff that went on in that case. This guy, Winter, got a really raw deal and the way they treated him.
Well, hey, Ed, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. You've been a great guest. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with digital private investigator Ed Opperman. And I highly recommend checking out the Opperman Report and, if you can, joining the members section at the Opperman Report website, which I've linked to in the episode description. To close out this episode, I've got another reworking of a Twin Peaks track. This time it's the Laura Palmer theme, as reworked by Theater of Delays. Check them out, folks!